Happening now, breaking news, defense of the deal. Labor Secretary Alex Acosta defends the secret 2008 plea deal he arranged as a U.S. attorney, which gave multimillionaire Jeffrey Epstein an easy sentence for sex crimes. President Trump pushed him before the cameras, but he still pushed him out the door. Call to resign. Speaker Nancy Pelosi adds her powerful voice to those calling on Alex Acosta to resign, adding that President Trump should ask him to step down. Navigating Mueller. House Democrats are preparing for next week's testimony by former special counsel Robert Mueller. But while the hearings are seen as a possible make-or-break moment for impeachment advocates, some Democrats are already tamping down expectations. And Ambassador quits. Britain's ambassador to the United States resigns after leaked diplomatic cables showed he had called President Trump insecure and incompetent, triggering a series of insults from the president. I'm Wolf Blitzer. You're in the Situation Room.
This is CNN Breaking News.
Breaking news, embattled Labor Secretary Alex Acosta goes public to defend the still shocking plea deal he oversaw as a U.S. attorney a decade ago, which gave multimillionaire Jeffrey Epstein a very light sentence for sex crimes involving underage girls. Acosta says his office stepped in when state prosecutors were ready to let Epstein walk. Epstein faces new federal charges for allegedly running a sex trafficking ring and abusing minors. Sources say President Trump told Acosta to step forward amid a drumbeat of calls for his resignation. Also tonight, House Democrats are scrambling to get ready for next week's testimony by former special counsel Robert Mueller. They're trying to make the most of limited time, but some are already cautioning against expecting too much from the hearings. The testimony is seen as a make-or-break moment for Democrats pushing for an impeachment inquiry. I'll speak with Senator James Lankford of the House of the Senate Homeland Security Committee and our correspondents and analysts. They will have full coverage of the day's top stories. But let's begin with the breaking news. Our chief White House correspondent, Jim Acosta, is standing by. Jim, the president's embattled labor secretary is defending his actions as a U.S. attorney a decade ago.
That's right, Wolf. In an update so far, officials over here at the White House believe Labor Secretary Alex Acosta handled himself well at that press conference earlier this afternoon. As we saw, as he came out in front of the cameras, there were no apologies, no regrets from the embattled labor secretary regarding his handling of the Jeffrey Epstein case. Secretary Acosta also claimed he still has the support of the president, even though Mr. Trump hasn't always stood by cabinet secretaries who have faced intense scrutiny in the past.
Under fire over a plea deal he once cut for multimillionaire sex offender Jeffrey Epstein, Labor Secretary Alex Acosta defended his handling of the case during his days as a federal prosecutor.
No regrets is a very hard question. You always look back and you say, what if?
With new victims coming forward questioning whether Acosta was too lenient in the case, the secretary was asked whether he would have reached the same agreement today. Time and again, he pointed the finger at state prosecutors in Florida, claiming they were going to allow Epstein to avoid jail time.
Today's world treats victims very, very differently. Today's world does not allow some of the victim shaming that could have taken place at trial. I don't think we can say, you know, take a case that is this old and fully know how it would play out today. We did what we did because we wanted to see Epstein go to jail. There is a value to a sure guilty plea because letting him walk, letting what the state attorney was ready to do go forward would have been absolutely awful.
The secretary made it clear he's not about to resign, talking up his relationship with President Trump while working in a plug for the administration's record.
My relationship with the president's outstanding. He has, I think, very publicly made clear that I've got his support. I serve at the pleasure of the president. I thought yesterday he was kind and he showed great support. We are here because we are part of an administration that is creating jobs.
A senior administration official told CNN the president's first instinct was to fight back against Democrats calling for the secretary's resignation. The official said Mr. Trump's attitude was, quote, screw him. The secretary also blasted reports that he's on thin ice with acting White House Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney.
Our relationship is excellent, too, in that any articles to the contrary are, in his words, BS.
In true Trump administration fashion, the secretary took a swipe at the media.
I've read this, and one of the things I find interesting is how facts become facts because they're in a newspaper. Thank you very much.
The question is whether the secretary's performance was enough to stay on. One of Mr. Trump's close friends was betting that his days were numbered.
I think the plea agreement he did is indefensible. I think that he's not going to stay for long.
But for now, it seems Secretary Acosta may be able to stay on for now, but the secretary may want to look back at how other embattled cabinet members have fared in the past. As one senior administration official put it, one day you're working for President Trump and one day you're not. There was one other departure here in Washington that was welcomed by the White House as the British ambassador to the U.S. announced he is stepping down after some of his past criticisms of Mr. Trump surfaced in the news media. One top White House official told reporters earlier today that that was the right course of action. That was one departure over here at the White House. They were welcoming, Wolf.
Jim Acosta at the White House for us. Thank you very much. Let's dig deeper right now. CNN's Kara Scannell is here in the Situation Room. Kara, you've been going through the legal documents around this 2007-2008 case. What did you find out?
Yeah, well, so I've been combing through the record in this case, and we found were a number of letters between 2007 and 2008, just after this non-prosecution agreement was reached, where lawyers for Jeffrey Epstein were reaching out to Alex Acosta, still trying to get him to knock two of his prosecutors off the case and to end the prosecution completely. When that failed, Epstein's legal team brought in Ken Starr, the lawyer who prosecuted or went after Bill Clinton in the Whitewater investigation, Monica Lewinsky, had him appeal to the Department of Justice in Washington. He reached out to the Criminal Division, the Child Exploitation Division, and the Deputy Attorney General's Office. And believe it or not, in one of those claims, they actually said that the prosecution of Epstein was politically motivated because of his, quote, close personal association with the former president, Bill Clinton. Now, the Deputy Attorney General's office, one of the assistants there had responded saying that the prosecution was, quote, appropriate. Now, remember, this prosecution wasn't even one that was ever really supposed to be made public. It involved no jail time and no actual federal charges. Well,
it's interesting, because when Alex Acosta, the labor secretary, was asked today to look back at his handling of this case, and I want to be precise, he didn't appear to accept direct responsibility. In fact, he repeatedly pointed to others.
Right. I mean, he pointed to both the state prosecutors on the case, and then he even was passing some of the blame onto his line assistants, mentioning, you know, specifically one of them and the conduct and the actions that she had taken in this case. Now, that runs counter to the record. You see in the court filings that Acosta was involved, that he did have meetings with one of his former law partners who was representing Jeffrey Epstein, and that it also runs counter to the other cases that Acosta's office brought during that exact same time period, where they prosecuted people for one person, one victim that they had assaulted, not what was alleged to be dozens of victims in that case.
Kara Scannell doing some good, important reporting for us. Thank you very much. Let's go to our senior congressional correspondent, Manu Raju. He's up on Capitol Hill. Manu, you just spoke with the House Speaker, Nancy Pelosi. What did she have to say about Secretary Acosta's news conference?
Well, Nancy Pelosi has been very clear that she wants nothing short of Alex Acosta's resignation as labor secretary. She said in the aftermath of the indictment of Jeffrey Epstein, she also made that clear in the days that have followed. And as she was leaving a briefing earlier this afternoon, I asked her about the press conference and Acosta making it very clear that he was not resigning. And she said this.
I should resign if the president should ask me to step down.
So the question is, what do Democrats do from here? Nancy Pelosi made clear to me yesterday that she didn't really have much of an interest of launching a full-scale investigation into this plea deal that was offered back in Florida to Jeffrey Epstein. She said that they want to focus on their legislative agenda instead. But there's some interest from one committee, the House Oversight Committee, which sent a letter to Alex Acosta asking him to testify later this month to lay out the details of this plea agreement. No word yet about whether or not Acosta will come and whether or not it will lead to a subpoena from the House Oversight Committee. So there is still some interest on Capitol Hill to get some more answers to what has happened here and whether Alex Acosta properly moved forward with that plea agreement more than a decade ago, Wolf.
Manu, what are you learning about the Democrats' strategy for next week's Robert Mueller testimony?
Well, behind the scenes, Democrats are scrambling to make sure that they get the most out of their time. They will have only actually 2 hours in two separate hearings, and that'll be split equally between Democrats and Republicans. So for the House Judiciary Committee, which has more than 40 members, each side will have 1 hour only to ask questions of Robert Mueller. Then the House Intelligence Committee will have a similar two-hour arrangement split equally between the two sides. So Democrats behind the scenes, Wolf, I'm told, are trying to figure out an exact strategy to get the answers they want to their questions. They're beginning meetings tonight, tomorrow as well, to figure out exactly what they want to ask, divide up their among their members, and effectively stick to the script. But what, Wolf, I'm hearing from a number of Democrats is they are concerned that just 2 hours won't be enough time to get exactly what they want, which is more information, to get the special counsel to detail all the allegations in a more than 400-page report. And already Democrats are saying that, look, we may need him to come back because that is just simply not going to be enough time. So right now, Democratic leaders are sorting out the logistics, trying to divide up how they want to ask their questions. But you're hearing some questions as the whole world will be watching, and people who are saying that this could change the dynamics, lead to an impeachment proceeding of this president. But some saying there's just not going to be enough time to get all of their questions answered. So at the moment, Wolf, Democrats trying to figure out exactly how to maximize their limited time with the special counsel.
Yeah, given the limited time, the Democrats and the Republicans, for that matter, they all have to be very disciplined and ask questions rather than make speeches, which they often like to do in these kinds of hearings. Manu Raju up on Capitol Hill, thank you very much. Joining us now, Republican Senator James Lankford of Oklahoma. He's a key member of the Homeland Security Committee. Senator, thanks so much for joining us.
Good to be with you, Wolf.
So we have lots to discuss, but let me begin with the breaking news. Should the Labor Secretary, Alex Acosta, resign over his handling of the Epstein case?
No, I don't think he should resign. I think we should allow the Department of Justice to do their investigation and the background work on this. What I'm disappointed at is so much of the coverage in the last really 48 hours on every network has been about President Trump and Acosta as Labor Secretary. And we've not really spent a lot of time talking about these girls that were abused in the process and trafficked, and about Epstein and what the horrific acts that he really did. Now, so this is a horrific crime. We need to keep the focus on it being a horrific crime. Let the Department of Justice do their investigation. They're now in their second investigation. Obviously, what happened in Florida a decade ago, and now in New York, to be able to finish this out with new additional witnesses. Let that go. Let's get this person prosecuted and go through the process and get justice to folks, and then allow that investigation to go forward and to go back and review what happened 10 years ago. I think it's appropriate. But the focus needs to be on those kids, especially, and actually getting justice to them.
Yeah, those girls were 14, 15 years old. Yeah. You make a very important
it's
point.
Horrific.
They clearly were abused, and that raises the question, why did the U.S. attorney at that time, Alex Acosta in South Florida, give this very lenient plea deal with Epstein?
Yep, and I think those are all legitimate questions to ask, and I think Department of Justice is going to pull that up. I think that'd be a normal investigation when they're retrying some of these issues and bringing up additional people with additional witnesses to go back and find out what did the state of Florida do? Why was the state of Florida struggling to be able to prosecute this case? How did it end up in the U.S. Attorney's office? And then how was the plea deal made? Very reasonable questions, and I think those answers should come out.
Because a federal judge, as you know, has said Alex Acosta violated the law by not telling Epstein's victims about the prosecution agreement that was worked out, the plea agreement that the government signed onto. Doesn't that alone warrant an apology from Alex Acosta?
Yeah, let's get all the details out on that and to be able to find out from Acosta. Again, he's got to be able to go back and review this with Department of Justice and to be able to make it right in any way that we can. But my impression is a lot of the push right now is because he's a Trump cabinet member, not because of the case. My focus would be let's focus on him as an attorney, not as a cabinet member and a U.S. attorney, and find out what mistakes were made. How do we never do this again? And how do we make sure that there aren't some other individuals in other places that we had a prosecution that was not fully fulfilled?
Yeah, but you make an important point. These were 14 and 15, 16-year-old girls who were abused in really awful ways. Would you like to see Secretary Acosta come before Congress so lawmakers like you and others can directly ask him questions about the decisions he made a decade ago?
So actually what I would like to see is the same what we would do with any other U.S. attorney. Let the Department of Justice to be go through the process on this. Let them do their investigation behind closed doors as they would for any other U.S. attorney to be able to get those hard questions. A deposition or a closed-door meeting will get much more out of it than a hearing would. The only reason a hearing is even being discussed in this is because he's Trump's Secretary of Labor. Otherwise, if this was any other U.S. attorney and any other question on a case, we'd be going through normal protocol. So I would ask that we go through normal protocol first, and then if we don't get good answers, then elevate Judiciary Committee.
Was he properly vetted in his confirmation hearings by the U.S. Senate? You voted to confirm, all the Republicans, I think,
I did.
Voted to confirm. Eight Democrats opposed it. One independent, Angus King of Maine. Eight Democrats supported his confirmation. One independent, Angus King, also supported right. his confirmation. Was he properly vetted? Only Senator Tim Kaine of Virginia even asked questions right. about the Epstein case.
So that's what I was actually about to say, yes, because that information was available. People could see it. Tim Kaine was able to ask information of him personally on that. So the White House had looked at it. Both Democrats and Republicans in the Senate had looked at it. There was the questions that were asked. Everyone thought they had sufficient answers to be able to go through the process. Now we have additional information, additional witnesses that are coming forward now that allows for a renewed prosecution in that case, which is a good thing for those victims to be able to go through.
Let's talk about the Robert Mueller upcoming testimony next yeah. week. One of Mueller's definitive conclusions right at the beginning of his 450-page report was that the Russians directly interfered in our 2016 presidential election. But at a briefing today up on Capitol Hill, top administration officials wouldn't even say whether President Trump has even received a comprehensive briefing on election security looking forward to 2020. I know you were at a sensitive briefing on this issue today as well. Does that worry you?
No, that doesn't worry me because I was in a briefing today with the head of the FBI, with the Office of National Intelligence, with Department of Homeland Security, multiple leaders from multiple different areas in our government, and to be able to get an update of what they're already doing to protect our elections for 2020, what they did for 2018, lessons learned from 2016, 2018, what they're applying for 2020. So they're a long way down the road. Now, they were very clear. They've had interaction with the president and with the White House. They've had a go on all of their work behind the scenes to be able to make sure that we're both working with individual states, and all 50 states now have an additional cyber protection on their election system that was not there 4 years ago. So dealing with cybersecurity is much more advanced now than what it was 4 years ago. There's a lot more awareness, interaction state to state, and then interaction agency to agency. So our questions were really focused on 2020. What are they doing rather than the politics behind the scenes on it? And I was very impressed with what has already been done and what they did in 2018, which we saw go off basically without a hitch in 2018 because of the aggressive measures they took.
You make a very important point, Senator Lankford, because all of the top national security intelligence, cybersecurity people in the administration, in the government, they are all on the same page. They have to do something very, very serious to stop right. the Russians. And they talk about it openly. They have no complaints about what the Mueller report came up with on that specific issue. But yeah. why do we never hear the president of the United States speak about this?
You'd have to ask him on that one or his spokesman on it. My perception is that he feels like there are still folks that are out there saying the only reason he's president is because the Russians were trying to interfere. He would obviously vehemently push back against that and say he worked very hard in the campaign and got more votes and all that process. So I think that his perception is what I get from him is there's a sense that some people are trying to delegitimize his election based on that. We have no evidence of any votes being switched during that time period. That's been very clear, been very consistent with all of our intelligence folks as they've gone through the process. And we need to continue to be vigilant to make sure that we continue to protect the system so that people can trust the system.
We got to go, but you have no doubt the Russians interfered.
Oh, I have no doubt the Russians tried to interfere in 2016. They started as early as 2014. I have no question they did that. And I have no question our government is standing up ready to be able to take them on for 2020, make sure they can push back on anything now.
And you have no doubt that their intention was to help Donald Trump get elected.
Oh, no, I have lots of doubts on that, because even things like the Christopher Steele, the famous dossier that was out there, I have no doubt that that was Russian generated as information that was counter to Trump. So there's a lot of things that were helpful to the president. There were lots of things that were hurtful to the president that were out there. So the Russians were playing both sides of this, trying to be able to create a stir as they went through the election, which they have certainly been successful at.
You know, they all conclude the Russians wanted to sow dissent, political dissent here in the United States. That was their goal. That's why they started this. But in the end, they really went out of their way to try to help Trump and hurt Hillary Clinton.
Yeah, they did more to help candidate Trump, no question, than they did Hillary Clinton. But they also had information going the other direction. They also had pro-Bernie Sanders things. They had pro-Green Party things that were out there. When you go back and see a breakdown of the things that they were doing in social media, by far they were doing more anti-Hillary Clinton, but they had a lot of other information, including, as I mentioned before, this famous dossier. That's a Russian document that was anti-Canada Trump at that point that they were getting out into the open. So there was quite a bit to go both sides on this.
All right, Senator Lankford, we'll continue this conversation. It's really important down the road. Thanks so much for joining us.
You bet.
Up next, Labor Secretary Alex Acosta rejects calls that he resign, defending the 2008 plea deal he arranged as a U.S. attorney, which gave multimillionaire Jeffrey Epstein a very light sentence for sex crimes. Plus, a hurricane watch issued for part of the Louisiana coast right now, and heavy rains are already causing serious problems along the central Gulf Coast. Stand by for the latest forecast. Breaking news, the Labor Secretary Alex Acosta this afternoon defended his actions when, as a federal prosecutor, he negotiated a plea deal with sex offender Jeffrey Epstein a decade ago. Acosta says he has no intention of resigning. Let's bring in our experts, our correspondents and our analysts to assess. And Caitlin, you were there at that news conference at the Department of Labor earlier today. And you've done some serious reporting on the pressure behind the scenes from the president on Alex Acosta to do something. Tell us about that.
Yeah, President Trump was the reason he came out today and did answer those questions from reporters, because they got on the phone yesterday and the president told him he needed to defend himself and do so in a press conference, maybe taking questions, because he wanted him to go out there and defend his actions as he oversaw that plea deal. Now, we reported last night that the president had been privately telling people he had confidence in Secretary Acosta, essentially making the same argument he did in the Oval Office yesterday, downplaying his role in the deal, saying that there were multiple people involved, and also stating that it was 11 years ago. Well, the president was saying it was a long time ago. So that is why he wanted him to come out and forcefully defend himself. And a lot of people in the West Wing were saying that this performance was really going to determine whether or not he stayed on as the labor secretary.
It's interesting, because during that news conference, Susan, the labor secretary repeatedly sought to deflect. He was blaming others, whether the state of Florida or career prosecutors. He didn't take responsibility.
Right. So he was certainly ready to throw just about everybody under the bus, intimating that the state was going to pursue lesser charges, that the responsibility lay with career prosecutors. But keep in mind, this was not a deal that just happened to occur at the U.S. Attorney's office while Acosta happened to be the boss. Acosta personally met with Epstein's lawyer, not at the U.S. Attorney's office, as one might expect, but instead at a Miami hotel, which goes to how incredibly irregular this was. It was at that breakfast meeting that they hashed out this deal, by which Epstein served only 13 months in prison, was essentially allowed to sort of come and go at will, essentially unheard of. They also agreed to immunize unnamed co-conspirators. It's really an astonishing deal, considering the strength of the evidence.
He says, Acosta, that 7 a.m. breakfast meeting with the lawyers representing Epstein was done after the plea deal had already been worked out.
Well, so the Miami Herald's reporting contradicts that. And I do think that one thing, for while Acosta deserves credits for answering an hour worth of questions today, he was not forthcoming on whether or not he fully informed the victims, right? He was evasive on some of these key details. So it's hard to say whether or not his account of the story is credible at this point.
Well, he said we didn't inform the victims because we were afraid that if they knew about money that might be coming to them, that it could be used against them by Epstein's attorneys. I mean, it seems to me that they were kind of bludgeoned by Epstein's lawyers.
And he had some pretty famous lawyers, Epstein, some high-powered lawyers.
He certainly did, including one of whom was a former law partner of Acosta's. But Acosta, as Susan was saying, was blaming everybody else for this and saying, you know, that arrangement was BS. He shouldn't have been allowed to go to work while he was serving his jail time. I mean, who did that? And he didn't really say what new evidence there is that he was praising the Southern District of New York for finding. What is there new about this? There were 36 victims at the time. I mean, wasn't that enough? And also, in this question of immunizing potential co-conspirators, he didn't really explain why that occurred, did he? I mean, I'm not a lawyer.
Is he too much of a liability now for the president?
You know, that's
also think we never know with this president, right? We've seen this over and over again with people who work for the president, even either in the cabinet or in the White House. There is lots of scrutiny, lots of damaging scrutiny and sort of damning evidence against them in terms of wrongdoing, or in this case, sort of, I think, what I thought was a bit of a pompous and weak performance by Acosta and seeming sort of to just go along and be railroaded by Epstein's lawyer. So we've seen this play out. It's all up to the president, ultimately. We don't know if at some point he changes his mind. We do know that his instinct is to fight, right? His instinct is to draw a line between folks who want to see folks in his administration go, folks who want to take him down, folks who want to take people who work with him down. And so he tends to kind of defend them at all costs. We've seen that over and over again. We'll see if this press conference makes a difference. I thought it was a terrible press conference. The sort of blaming the timing of it, saying, oh, you know, this was a very, very, very long time ago. It was only 11 years ago. And these victims would have been treated differently then than they would have been now. I thought it was a terrible performance.
Everybody stand by. There's a lot more we need to discuss. We'll take a quick break. We'll be right back. We're back with our analysts and our experts. We're looking ahead to the Mueller testimony, Gloria, next week. Nancy Pelosi met with the Democratic caucus in the House of Representatives today. She pleaded for unity at one point, saying, quote, "You got a complaint, you come and talk to me about it, but do not tweet about our members and expect us to think that that is just okay." Clearly, there's a rift emerging between her and some of the more liberal, younger members emerging.
Right, and I don't blame her, quite frankly. She's a leader of the party in the House, and what she is saying to them is not that you can't complain. Sure, you can complain, but how about coming to me so I don't have to read it on Twitter first? And I think she put out the word there. Look, you don't have to stand in line behind me all the time, but we have to have a united front because we're dealing with these hugely important issues. And of course, this comes on the heels of her saying to Maureen Dowd in the New York Times,
right, yeah.
They have four votes. And by the way, she was also right about that. They have four votes. And so I think she's kind of saying to them, you know, I'm not going to roll over for you. And you need to understand where I am coming from and how important these issues are. And so, yeah, there's a rift in the Democratic Party.
I mean, that was a low blow, I thought, for Nancy Pelosi to go and talk to Maureen Dowd in this pretty big piece in the New York Times and sort of trash these younger members who do have a following and do have a perspective. And it's not just on Twitter. It's an entire wing of the Democratic Party. So for her, I think, to come and say, oh, we should make nice. Well, you know, Nancy Pelosi, you were trashing them in the pages of the New York Times very publicly.
She was there's a serious rift that has emerged. How's the White House, Caitlin, viewing all this?
With glee.
Sure. Right.
They love any kind of division with the Democratic Party that is part of it is saying that the president should be impeached. Other half of it is conducting widespread investigations into the president. And then, of course, there are over two dozen-ish around that. Democrats running against Donald Trump, hoping to beat him in the presidential election. So any kind of division like this between a party that is center-left and a party that is way more to the left, that is something that the White House and the Trump campaign wants to not only see but also exploit over the next year and a half as they try to make the argument for why Trump should be reelected.
Because Nancy Pelosi, Susan, she's been a minority leader in the House of Representatives, and she's been Speaker of the House of Representatives. She wants to stay on as Speaker. She wants the Democrats after the next election to maintain that majority and not go back to the minority.
Yeah, and I think she recognizes that any internal divisions among the Democrats are going to help Trump get reelected, and that's what she's up against, and that these tweets from younger members, they might be popular sort of on social media and with one wing of the party, but at the end of the day, they don't actually help advance a progressive agenda. They don't get bills drafted or passed, and so eventually people are going to have to decide whether or not they are playing a team sport here, because if they are divided, they are not going to unseat an incumbent president.
You know, she's got these, 30 moderates? She's got to worry about who were elected in Trump districts. And she, you know, she's kind of given them a master class here on how this place works and saying to them, I want to remain, in not so many words, I need to remain Speaker of the House, and you are not helping us, and you have to figure out which side you're on. And she's saying, you know, sometimes you need to compromise, dirty word, and you may have to learn that, just like she had to learn it when she had to compromise herself.
But that said, she's not just resisting this far left wing. Pelosi's also resisting major calls for impeachment, calls for basic oversight into things like Alex Acosta's handling for Epstein. And so she's finding herself further and further, not just from the very progressive wing, but even from some of the centrists at this
point. The consequences are enormous in this feud that has emerged. Guys, stick around. There's more breaking news. A hurricane watch has just been issued for part of the Louisiana coast. We have the latest forecast. Breaking news, a hurricane watch has just been issued for parts of the Louisiana coast ahead of a storm that isn't even fully formed yet. Let's go to our meteorologist, Tom Sater. Tom, what's happening in the Gulf of Mexico?
Well, Wolf, we don't even have a tropical depression yet, but how this formed is extremely interesting. This came from a bit of energy inland and then drifted south into the Gulf of Mexico. Hurricane season started on June 1st. This could be a hurricane as we look at the weekend. It'll be the first landfall during the month of July in the Gulf since 2008, and that was Dolly, that moved into Texas. Tropical storm watch from the Pearl River to the mouth of the Mississippi. In pink is a hurricane watch from the mouth of the Mississippi across all the way over toward Cameron, Louisiana. There's a lot of uncertainty of where this is going to make landfall, but there are a couple of things we know for sure. A precursor today, tremendous amounts of rainfall, two tornado watches, a flash flood emergency with over 250 emergency calls today as the system brushed through the area. The river system can't take any more right now. Just to give you an idea, the broad circulation is still well off to the west. In the next 24 hours, we could have a named storm, Barry. And then as it makes its way through this bath water, this is like a hot tub in the Gulf. It's warmer than it should be, Wolf. We're expecting some intensification to get to Category 1 hurricane. But it doesn't matter the category right now. This is all about the rain. We had 9.42 inches. This is a 50-year event. Following the 100-year event you had up in D.C., but it's about the warnings. When Hurricane Katrina made landfall, the levee on the Mississippi River in New Orleans was just over 3 feet. Right now, that same levee is at 16, expected to go to 20. The record is 21. This could be the highest level at this levee system in 90 years. At 20 feet, Wolf, we're looking at this rainfall and this level to be right at the top of the levee system. This is going to be a real test on this system as we watch the system move in for the weekend. But it's all about 10, 15, maybe 20 inches of rain to come.
Yeah, next month it'll be 14 years since Hurricane Katrina hit that Louisiana area. Tom Sater will stay on top of this very serious development indeed. Yep. Coming up, a former U.S. Marine threatened by North Korea. Could Kim Jong-un's hitmen target him and others right here in the United States? Kim Jong-un's regime may be planning to make a move against an American accused of leading a stunning raid on a North Korean embassy. Brian Todd has been working his sources for us. Brian, what are you learning?
Well, we have new information tonight from an attorney for that American man involved in the embassy raid in Spain and from court documents. They confirm the North Koreans have put a target on this man's back. And even if they're in the U.S., Spain, or elsewhere, neither he nor one of his cohorts are safe from the long arm of Kim Jong-un's intelligence service. Tonight, new indications that North Korea's violent young dictator could be targeting some of his highest profile adversaries, who are Americans, for assassination. They're members of a group called the Provisional Government of Free Joseon, whose goal is to overthrow Kim Jong-un's regime. One of their members, former U.S. Marine Christopher Ahn, has just been granted bail by a judge in L.A. and should be under house detention within days. Ahn and other members of Free Joseon are accused of leading a brazen, broad daylight raid on North Korea's embassy in Madrid in February, making away with thumb drives, hard drives, computers, and cell phones. Ahn was arrested in L.A. in April, and Spain wants the U.S. to extradite him there. Ahn's lawyer tells CNN she's fighting that.
There are people on the ground who are connected to the North Korean government. They can reach out to people in Spain if they want to commit a crime or harm somebody.
The judge in Ahn's case backs her up, writing in a court order, the FBI has confirmed that the North Korean government has threatened his life. He is apparently the target of a dictatorship's efforts to murder him. Ahn's lawyer says she fears he'd be in danger even if he's incarcerated in Spain. Danger from North Korean agents and their criminal contacts.
The officials there are probably in touch with people in the underworld in Spain, people who would have no problem finding their way into a Spanish jail if Mr. An were to be detained there.
An's lawyer is concerned that North Korean agents could even get to him while he's in the U.S. One former spy says North Korea could well have a network of operatives in the L.A. area, and they wouldn't blink at targeting An there.
They wouldn't hesitate of killing somebody in the United States. They're not going to. It's a vicious regime, as we know.
Christopher An is not the only leader of Free Joseon who's apparently in danger tonight. American Adrian Hong, accused by Spain of being the mastermind of the embassy raid, is in hiding, on the run from U.S. marshals and, his lawyer says, North Korean agents.
We know from credible sources that the North Korean government is seeking Adrian Hong and some of his associates from the provisional government of Free Joseon and is seeking to target them for assassination.
Police!
U.S. authorities raided Hong's apartment in April, but he wasn't there. The lawyers for Hong and An deny Spain's accusations that they beat and tied up North Korean officials during the embassy raid in February. Still, analysts say Kim Jong-un must be enraged over that incident.
To have someone enter the North Korean embassy, take control of it for some time, would really be seen as quite an insult, quite a criticism of North Korea. So Kim would take that personally. It would be seen as a personal affront of the regime. So he would want to lash out.
Tonight, the attorneys for Christopher An and Adrian Hong are also critical of the Justice Department, saying that it's dismaying that the department has executed warrants against Americans based on the accounts of North Korean officials in Spain. Those attorneys tell CNN they are worried that An and Hong, if he's ever caught, could eventually be extradited actually to North Korea if they're not harmed first. Justice officials tell CNN anyone extradited to Spain is going to get due process under Spanish law, and they've indicated they are not likely to help facilitate any extraditions to North Korea. Wolf?
All right, Brian, good report. Thank you very much. Coming up, Labor Secretary Alex Acosta rejects calls to resign, defending the secret 2008 plea deal he arranged as a U.S. attorney, which gave multimillionaire Jeffrey Epstein an easy sentence for sex crimes. Will President Trump stand by him?
Now streaming exclusively on Max, a new CNN flash doc about the album that has Nashville talking, Call Me Country, Beyonce and Nashville's Renaissance. Watch it at max.com/callmecountry. Max subscription required.